Bonjour and welcome to episode 9, Mwanji Thawk of the Treaty 1 Nation podcast presented by T1DC, the Treaty 1 Development Corporation, and Treaty 1. In this episode, I'm joined by Elder Dr. Dave Kershane from Saugeen First Nation to speak about the history behind the signing of the first treaty in 1871. We're also going to speak about what's being done today and what we can do in the future to ensure a safe and harmonious life for all peoples within Canada. Bonjour Annie. Bonjour Moshkate Bijike and Tishnikazki Kunto Demanishinambe Aki. Hello to all of my cousins and relatives across Turtle Island and of course from nation to nation of all treaty territories here within Canada. My name is Taylor from Broken Head Ojibwe Nation here in Treaty 1 territory, but we're recording this episode in Selkirk, Manitoba, which is still in Treaty 1 territory and very, very close to the location of Lower Fort Garry where Treaty 1 was signed 150 years ago, coming up this August 3rd, 1871 is when all of this happened. So we're here talking about more so the history, the events that led up to the signing of Treaty 1 150 years ago, like said. And me and Dave, we sat down, Elder Dave and I sat down and we discussed some of the atrocities that happened during this time that led up to this specific date of when settlers were coming in, when people from overseas were coming into Canada, how they manipulated First Nations people and convinced them that we can have this togetherness, we can live together peacefully in this nation, which we all know has not been that way throughout history. We've seen a lot of pain and a lot of hardships, a lot of loss, a lot of depression, a lot of mental health issues, and a lot of issues that surround the residential schools, which also, not too long ago, we are still dealing with today when 215 children's bodies were found at a residential school site in Kamloops out in British Columbia. When I think about these types of things, I sit and I wonder and I ponder to myself, why on earth are people still saying to this day that it's time that we move on and it's time that we get over it and it's time that Indigenous people become a part of Canada and not have special or specific rights that don't pertain to all people. And then when you see these types of events that become global news events of these 215 children that were found at this residential school site, you sit there and you think and you're getting heated and worked up because now you're thinking about these people who have asked you this question as to why you can't just get over it. And you know why? It's because it's still happening to this very day. Colonization, taking children away from their homes, doing so many things to Indigenous people. And it seems that in this 150 years, we haven't really grown or learned from any type of mistake. We're still here fighting our fight for land back, to protect the water, to protect our children, the youth, the elders, the knowledge keepers. And yet we have the crown and government officials who don't see this way of life as acceptable, in quotations. If you could see me, I'm doing air quotes right now. And it's hard for me to sit here and think about celebrating something such as this, celebrating something that may be monumental because it's been so long since this treaty was signed and it was supposed to be this step forward into this positive and respectful partnership between these two groups of people, which it has not been. So the reason why we decided to call this episode Mawanji Thawag is because in the Ojibwe translation, it means they come together, meet with one another, have a meeting, which in itself is totally fitting because that's exactly what we're talking about. at this time, 150 years ago, we had our ancestors of these seven First Nations belonging to Treaty One, and we had these government officials joining together at Lower Fort Garry, which actually is like a 5-10 minute drive away from where I am right now. And they sat in these fields and they discussed and they negotiated and they talked about all these things about how to live together. And then on August 3rd, this treaty was signed. But don't take all of this just from me. We're going to be joined by Elder Dave Crescane shortly. But I just wanted to kind of just let you give you a bit of background information. You know that I always like to do that. But so treaties, in case you may not know, treaties are their promises, their obligations. They're supposed to benefit and not hurt the other party that's involved with them. They were signed across Canada, signed across nation to nation, and it was meant for us to coexist and live in peace and harmony. However, that hasn't happened. We're still working towards this so-called truth and reconciliation that we're trying to accomplish. But here in Treaty One, it was signed on August 3rd, 1871 by representatives of the Crown and of Indigenous communities. There are seven First Nations that were a part of the signing of Treaty One, which I had mentioned. Of course, that's Broken Head Ojibwe Nation, where I'm from, Sagging First Nation, Long Plain First Nation, Peguis, Roseau River Anishinaabe, Sandy Bay, and Swan Lake. Now today, present day, these seven communities are coming together to show and reflect and I guess to celebrate this significant time in our history on August 3rd. So we have this huge launch, these big kickoff virtual parties and events that you can join. You got to visit treatyone.ca to find out more information and stay updated on what T1DC and Treaty One are conjuring up in their cauldron of events and fun things and teaching experiences and learning experiences for all peoples that want to join in. So please, like said, visit treatyone.ca for more information. Without further ado, I'd like to bring in a very well-respected, a very well-known, a very important person to all of our communities within Treaty One. I was recently joined by Dr. Dave Crescane from Sagging to chat about the history of the treaty, what we can do in the future, and so much more. Here is our interview.
I'm known as Dave Crescane, Sagging First Nation member of Treaty One.
We're here today because the big anniversary of the signing of Treaty One is fast approaching on August 3rd, 150 years since then. But could you give our listeners a bit of background on what exactly a treaty is and why the signing of Treaty One was so important in our history?
You know, for me, I've always tried to get as deep an understanding as I could or as I can in regards to what is the real meaning of treaty. Because I've heard, many different interpretations from our own people and certainly from the Crown's perspective. And I've always looked upon it as, the treaties affirmed, the inherent right of our sovereignty as a people, that we have our own identity complete with our own tribal governments and having the ability to manage our lands, resources, and also a responsibility to protect the people. And looking up, the term treaties, treaties are significant pacts and contracts that are an enduring relationship of mutual obligation that facilitated a peaceful coexistence between First Nations and the non-First Nations people. Because when I look back and I hear some of the knowledge keepers and the ones that do have the knowledge to be able to speak about the significance and importance of treaties, it always hinges on, like a spiritual understanding, of mutual respect. Because it, You know, our people understood by signing the treaties we were agreeing to share and not to give up our lands. We were to have equal access to and proportionate return on the abundance of the land. For the first peoples, for the original people, we do not have a concept of land ownership, rather a sense of belonging to the land and responsibility for taking care of the land, you know, where we have traditionally lived. It would have been considered absurd for us to give away lands that we did not feel we owned. Rather, it was an intention in signing these treaties to agree to share stewardship of the lands, and also in the bounty, the spirit of mutual respect was never reciprocated. The more that I've been able to read the treaties and consult historians and people that, you know, have some legal understanding of that documents, you know, they confirm what I feel, that it is very much a one-sided agreement that we certainly did not benefit from. And it was the other party that really benefited, you know, from those treaties, because it was a tool for them. It was an instrument, you know, to subjugate us, to dominate us, and to seize the lands, you know, from their context of describing treaty as a legal document. 5 years after the signing of Treaty One, Parliament passed a legislation called the Indian Act. And I think that they left one word out when they designed that act, when they called it the Indian Act. They should have called it the Indian Domination Act. And the other question I've often asked is, you know, what gave them the right to negotiate land that they never had in the first place? Because according to some of the history that I've written or I've read, that King Charles II gave a charter to the Hudson Bay Company, a private entity, a private company. Most of the 1/3 of the land that is now Canada, the Hudson Bay did is they turned around and sold that land back to the British government and then ceded that land back to what was called Canada. And in all these negotiations, there was no involvement whatsoever of the First Peoples in regards to the land itself.
Do you think things would have been better or worse if a treaty wasn't signed?
You know, I couldn't say that for sure, because I would have to, you know, to have some faith in the ancestors when they did sign those treaties. I believe that they went into ceremony, you know, to get direction and guidance if they should sign those treaties, that the military was used psychologically all around our leaders of that time, you know, to give the impression that there was a force, you know, that was reflecting its presence through the military. I think that the reason why, you know, there's still some substance, you know, to the treaties, that in order to have a treaty, you have to have the existence of two sovereign entities. And I think if we begin on that basis and that foundation, then that's the way we must proceed. That those treaties, you know, they're recognized internationally, because it's a formally and ratified agreement between two countries or two sovereignties. And treaties are binding agreement between nations to become part of international law. So that is where I would hold on to, you know, to what the treaties really mean. But it's certainly not the intent. That was not the intent of the Crown to be able to negotiate at that level of mutual respect of two sovereign identities. what they wanted, and they were brilliant in terms of how they orchestrated this, you know, to seize the land, because they saw the resources that they could benefit from. They wanted the Indian out of the way so they can get access to the land, and that's how reservations were formed shortly after, you know, the signing of the treaties.
Mm-hmm.
And what gave them the right, you know, to be the monopoly in terms of deciding who, what kind of land and whose land, that how much land that the native people would be getting into, was not even, it was not even, you know, their land. We were the stewards of the land. We never claimed ownership of the land. That was beyond our concept as a people to say that we could own Mother Earth. We were the first peoples here. This is the creation story of our people, that the Creator put us in this part of the world that we call Turtle Island. And then suddenly, you know, a new relative came upon our lands and, you know, used the concept of domination. And even before the signing of those treaties, and what was the foundation of that, you know, the colonizer, and what had happened was they had these, what they call papal bulls. The papal bulls were issued by the Vatican, forming the foundation of their presumed legal supremacy. European thinkers of the time, such as Thomas Hobbes and John Locke, shaped the philosophy and thinking of the newcomers. Hobbes used the social contract method to arrive at an astonishing conclusion that we ought to submit to the authority of an absolute, unlimited sovereign power, which was preferable over following natural laws, which he believed would cause lack of basic security and instability. Locke believed that people would be best served by turning over the authority of their power and governance to a government body implemented through a constitution, which led to the doctrine of discovery, a set of flawed 15th century assumptions regarding preemptive rights in the new world that established the spiritual, political, and legal justification for the seizure of the land. The doctrine of discovery was a series of papal bulls that sanctioned, enforced, and authorized territorial sovereignty for Catholic monarchs from inception to integration into Canadian law. The doctrine of discovery affirms the legacy of papal bulls from the Royal Proclamation to the Constitution Act of 1982. And the papal bulls authorized the full and free permission to invade, search out, capture, vanquish, and subdue all Saracens and pagans, and to reduce their persons into perpetual slavery, became the basis of all European claims in North America. Land uninhibited by Christians could therefore be discovered and exploited by divine decree, so that the Christian religion be exalted and be everywhere increased. Papal bulls rationalized the dehumanization of indigenous people, as well as their dispossession and silence. And that is something that is very rarely talked about. You know, I've met a lot of people in my travels, and they are individuals that do bring, you know, the foundation of the relation, the supposed relationship that we're supposed to be having with the crown. And it is not based on mutual respect, you know, by the fact that in 1492, you know, King Charles II, you know, gives a charter to his nephew, Cousin Rupert, and called it Rupert's Land. Like, how ridiculous is all of this?
Very, very ridiculous.
You know, and then we expect people to treat us with, you know, with respect and with dignity, but I think that's hoping for a lot. Like, how can Canada stand up today and celebrate Canada in a few weeks? Where does the native people fit in all of this? We can't celebrate it through our treaties, because they never took, they never seriously accepted that spirit of mutual respect. It was never reciprocated. They wanted the land, and they got the land.
So there's seven First Nation communities here within Treaty 1. And August 3rd, 1871, as you mentioned, was the event that had occurred where Treaty 1 was signed at Lower Fort Garry here in Manitoba. Could you share some of the knowledge that you have about the events surrounding that particular day?
You know, we're an oral people, and a lot of, you know, the what we do carry in terms of knowledge has always been passed orally. And, you know, we have to depend on our people that, you know, that have that gift to be able to remember and put forward, you know, the memory of, you know, of certain events. And certainly, you know, the signing of Treaty 1, you know, has to be considered an historic event. And there are people that I've heard, you know, they talk about, you know, how our people were camped near the fort. And then the ceremonies did not happen inside the fort of negotiations, but they were meeting on the side with their knowledge keepers. And the best way that I can understand, you know, the outcome of that was that, you know, through the ceremony, they were advised to sign those agreements, but under duress, because, you know, they knew that if they didn't do something, that they stand to lose everything. Because the military was being brought in and, you know, legislation was already being passed. They had already, you know, reflected this arrogant attitude that they already were in control. And they made themselves appear to be. You know, you have to remember, you know, our people are a spiritual people. Our people, you know, assumed that they were dealing with a people that, you know, that had some dignity and respect, but that's not what history is reflecting today. You know, they were more or less, I would say, be forced into a situation, the best of a very, very, very bad situation. And, you know, no one can argue the fact that Canada practiced genocide. And we see it being uncovered every day, you know, through the institution of the boarding schools. That was all done after the treaty. So where was that mutual respect? And when our people, I'm sure, asked, you know, to have a school, it wasn't with the assumption it would be a white man's school. They wanted to have their children to be taught by their own, not by pedophiles, not by people, you know, that abused our people in every way possible. I don't believe our people ever thought that would ever happen.
So go ahead.
There is no reconciliation in this country. You know, you look at the current situations that we see, you know, being covered every day. The first thing that happens is an apology. Yeah, we have to accept the apology because we're a forgiving people. But what about an act of correcting the wrong, you know, and make it right? Where is that? The Indian Act continues to be enforced, you know, and the authorities that are under the Crown, you know, act the same way to impose their authority on us, whatever that is, whatever, you know, the existing authority that, you know, that is derived from the Crown is certainly not for the benefit of the Indian. And we see it exposed every day. And we call it systemic racism. It's done every day. Our people feel it every day.
All, like, you're making, like, such strong, powerful points. And the last question that I have for you is, as we move forward and we approach this day, August 3rd of this year, the 150th anniversary. And we know there's going to be a lot of online events because of COVID and all these different types of celebrations and things like that. What is one thing, and you may have already touched on this, but what is one thing that you hope people can remember from this significant day, this 150th day, but not just from the 150, but also from the original day of the treaty signing? What do you people remember about this day?
You know, I would take, you know, that we take this day to remember the ancestral ways of our people, you know, who had lived on this land for tens of thousands of years, and the darkness and the suffering that we had to go through in order to maintain, you know, a faith and belief and a way of life that has survived and it will survive. But there's been so much casualties in terms of the negative impacts that have been created by the genocide itself. So I think we need to take that day, you know, and really reconcile with ourselves. You know, are we going to, you know, to go back and pick up the gifts that the Creator had given us to help us to be the people that we are, that we have an identity? And our identity comes from that spiritual foundation that we have and that relationship that we have with the Creator, the relationship that we have with the land that is so sacred that we call Mother Earth, and the relationship that we have with our ancestors, you know, that sit in the four directions, you know, waiting to be invoked by us through the gifts of the pipe, the wall, the drum. What beautiful gifts. And I think if we celebrate in a ceremonial way, not the domination, you know, that we continue to, you know, to be under, that's not what we celebrate. We celebrate our freedom, that we are going to be who we are. These treaties, you know, have been totally ignored. But that's not an excuse for me or any one of our people not to practice their identity and who they are and to be able to lift their pipe in freedom and to ask the higher power that exists, you know, for the wrongs to be corrected that man refuses to do himself. Let the forces of nature bring man to submission for the wrongs that he has done to a people that were so kind, that are so giving, and that are so sharing. Because that's all we've ever been, is a people that have been able to give and to be able to share. And we do it again. We share our heart. We share our knowledge. We share our teaching on how to treat the land. They don't know how to treat the land. All they see is dollar signs and how they can exploit everything that they can, you know, because of the value of greed. We are not a greedy people. And what we should be celebrating that day is our identity as a people, to really celebrate it, you know, that we have a duty and responsibility to share the rules of conduct to people that have arrived on our homeland. They're certainly not listening, but there should be a major campaign across this country educating the Canadian public, you know, to get to know who Indigenous people are. We are a giving people. We are a spiritual people. And there's much we can teach them on how to take care of the land.
Chi-mi-gwech, Elder Dave Kershane from Sagin, for joining us. As you can see throughout this conversation, the more we dug deeper into this history or even into the meaning behind what this treaty was supposed to signify, you can really hear in Elder Dave's voice the frustration that comes with talking about how this last 150 years have progressed or digressed in that case. So Miigwech, Elder Dave Kershane, for joining me on this episode of the Treaty One Nation podcast. We've reached the end of episode 9, Mawanji Itawag, of the Treaty One Nation podcast presented by T1DC and the Treaty One Nation. I'd like to say Miigwech as well to UMFM 101.5 for hosting our podcast. That is the University of Manitoba's radio station. So thank you to all of them. And of course, Chi-mi-gwech to you for tuning in, for learning with us and for listening with us and for sharing with us. If there's anything that you would like to know more about, or if you have any questions and concerns about the podcast or the upcoming events or anything whatsoever, visit treatyone.ca.